commandment is thou shalt not murder, or thou shalt not kill. All right, here are some questions in this examination of conscience, and we'll take some topics in particular. Okay, the first one in here is, have I been impatient, angry, jealous, unkind, proud, or hateful? All right, have I injured anyone else's reputation through gossip, slander, detraction, or calumny? We talked a little bit about this in the last class, not under this commandment, but under sins against speech, in a lot of cases dealing with things against the seventh commandment. Have I harbored hatred or held a grudge? Have I refused to forgive someone? Am I bigoted or prejudiced? Have I committed gluttony? Have I physically injured someone? Have I been physically or verbally abusive to my spouse, children, siblings, or parents? Have I driven aggressively or recklessly, putting other persons' lives in danger? Have I jeopardized the lives of others by drunk driving? Have I killed anyone? Have I neglected the care of the infirm, the elderly, or the handicapped who are in my charge? Have I committed euthanasia or so-called mercy killing? Have I taken part in an assisted suicide, or have I attempted suicide myself? Have I been negligent in caring for the health of my body, which is a temple of the Holy Spirit? Have I abused drugs or alcohol? Have I used contraceptives that can cause early abortions? For example, the pill, the IUD, Depo Provera, or Norplant. Have I taken part or had an abortion? Am I pro-choice? As a public official, have I worked to keep the sin of abortion legal? Have I participated in vitro fertilization? Okay, that's a pretty hefty list, wouldn't you say? That's not like light sledding tonight. We got some topics to cover. All right. And then now I'm going to start with the 10th commandment, actually, because this is a pretty small section, and then we can really dive into the 5th commandment stuff, okay? So the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, sometimes also associated with the 7th commandment, thou shalt not steal. So here are some. Let's see here. Have I failed to make my just contribution to church and to spread the Catholic religion? Have I taken advantage of or contributed to the oppression of the poor in any way? Have I been indifferent towards the poor? Have I gambled excessively or speculated rashly? Have I failed to fulfill my contracts? Have I failed to give a fair wage to my employees? Or have I failed to put in a full day's work for a full day's pay? Right. So those are some questions there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I think the whole notion of coveting, strictly speaking, is desiring someone else's things, okay, more than mere admiratio. Admiration is like you say, someone has a nice car, that's a nice car, okay? Now, coveting doesn't mean that you have to wish it did get knocked off so that somehow you'd possess it. Okay, that's a little bit extreme, okay, and I'm highly unlikely you would get the car anyway, okay? But I'm often reminded, for example, of my sister, who has, for a couple of years now, been begging me to take out a life insurance policy on myself to make her the sole beneficiary, okay? All right, so I said, well, why don't you just pay the, you know, whatever premium a month? No, it's your policy. You're the sole beneficiary. Okay, I mean, if I get knocked off, who do you think they're going to investigate first? She goes, oh, yeah. I'm like, okay, wait a minute here. Wait, this conversation is getting out of control. All right, so, you know, the question really is, I mean, there's even this thing called, for example, I mean, if you admire someone else's property or their house or something like that, that's fine. I mean, there's no problem in saying, you know, that's a beautiful painting. Or you can even say, you know, I wish I had one. Or I wish I could afford one. Okay, that's fine. I mean, you know, that could be a legitimate aspiration. I mean, it's a nice thing to have. Okay, but I think where this whole sin gets a little bit gnarly for people is when you're talking about coveting as is to mean, I want to possess it either A, at the expense of others, B, beyond my means, or C, as an idol. You see? And trust me, people do treat some of their property as an idol. They really do. You know, I mean, even like a lot of people who live beyond their means, they treat treat the equity on their home as like an ATM. All right? And they're living well beyond what they're supposed to be living on. You know, a lot of this financial crisis we're in right now, that's a driver in it. Not the only thing, but that is a driver in it. Lots of people in our country living well beyond their means. They cannot afford to live the lifestyles they lead. Okay? That all comes back to coveting. All right, because why? It's this accumulation and possession of goods. I've got to keep up with the Joneses or my life is not complete until I have this car or this house or live in this neighborhood or in this zip code. Okay. You know, that's true, clearly beyond what is licit. All right. Any questions about that? Because I kind of really want to move away from that. I don't think that this issue is very controversial for a lot of people, or it doesn't really require a lot of elucidation. I think all of us, at one point or another in our lives, do sense the temptations that are out there regarding material possessions. I don't think that's anything that's unique to anybody. I think everyone sees that from time to time. And you know how it is. Even during the Christmas season, the indulgence of the Christmas season, you know, I joke with Brother Priest, you know, one of the more commonly confessed sins during this time of year is drunkenness and gluttony, right? Or think of Thanksgiving, right? Somehow we give ourselves a pass that Thanksgiving is the one day a year where gluttony is permitted, right? And I'm like, why? And why do you have to be gluttonous on, and must you be gluttonous on Thanksgiving? I mean, I thought the point of it was not to stuff yourself with turkey and watch football. I thought the point of it was to give thanks. And hopefully, if possible, to be with your family, to do so. I thought that was the point of it. You know, and other purists out there who, like, you know, only say turkey only. You know, and we're Asian, so we always eat Peking duck. Okay? So, all right? I mean, is the turkey the point? Right? Or is it, you know, the fact that we're together and giving thanks? And it's interesting, too, because how few people actually come to Mass on Thanksgiving when the word Eucharistein is Greek for Thanksgiving. Every time we celebrate the Eucharist, we are giving thanks to God for the immense gift of His body, blood, soul, and divinity that we can actually consume. Okay, not as a consumer product, but as a method of communion with our living God. Okay, so on this backboard here, you can't see it. Next week, this is what I'm going to cover, okay? I just want to bracket this off. All right, embryonic stem cell research, cloning, contraception, natural family planning, surrogate motherhood, self-abuse, infidelity, and onanism. I'm going to cover all that next week, see? Everyone's getting excited. All right, I'm coming back for that one, okay? Today, we're going to cover euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, abortion, capital punishment, and just war. Got it? Okay, so you want to write these down, put them on the top of your page, because I'm going to ask someone for what's next. Euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, that's one. Second is abortion. Next is capital punishment, and then just war. We'll talk about just war at the end. All right, so let's talk about abortion first. All right. Does anyone, well, I actually don't want to put this question out rhetorically. I'll just talk about it. You know, in this last election regarding the abortion question, many practicing Catholics were very distraught to know how many people who claim to be Catholic in the exit polls voted for the easiest, most pro-abortion presidential candidate ever in history. And I'm not speaking that politically, that's just his record, okay? And, you know, and he's very proud of that, by the way. That's not something that's being hidden, okay? However, one of the statistics that is deceiving is that the people who identify themselves as Catholic were not further parsed out into two groups, practicing versus non-practicing, okay? So if you go to the election poll and you vote, and you haven't been to church since your first communion, but you don't really go to any other church, and you say, I'm Catholic. Boom, you're in the stat. Okay? So the numbers are highly inflated. The stat I want to know is, what percentage of practicing Catholics voted pro-choice? Now, they might not have voted for the president-elect because of abortion. It wasn't even on their issue. That wasn't really on their short list of things that helped shape their decision-making, okay? Which is, of course, already in and of itself problematic, because then the priority of goods and rights are already skewed. That's an entirely different discussion. All right? But I just want you to know, especially for your practicing Catholics out there, do not be discouraged by the number per se. It was over 60% of people who identify themselves as Catholic voted for Obama. Okay? But that's not to say that all six of those people, they are all practicing Catholics. The incidence for people not voting for Obama who are practicing Catholics was very low. Okay? It was like just over 10%. In my mind, still too high, but a lot better than 60%. You see what I'm saying? Okay. So, that being said, now, interestingly enough, 6 months ago, maybe it's 4 months ago, you may have seen on the news this rhetorical debate played out between Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, and then some of our bishops, and they called into, especially Nancy Pelosi, she's the Speaker of the House, Democrat from California, and she called into question the church's tradition on the teaching on abortion. She said that the church has still not formally or definitively said that abortion is wrong in all cases. Okay? Which is really wonderful, because now Nancy Pelosi becomes a spokesperson for the Catholic Church. All right? The media welcomes that, all right? So, Nancy Pelosi's wrong, all right? Abortion actually is one of the few sins that has always been considered an intrinsic, that means inherent unto itself, evil from the earliest tradition of the faith. In fact, if you look at some historians' records, the historian Eusebius, the great Roman historian, says this very, very succinctly, writing in the 4th century. Eusebius of Caesarea is writing and saying how abortion has always been considered, you know, a crime against God that cries out for vengeance, and a sin against humanity, right? To kill the child in the womb. All right. Now, it's interesting because what he does in one of his tracts is that he equates the introduction of two things, euthanasia at the end of life, right, mercy killing, supposed mercy killing, and abortion at the beginning of life, as two actions that were considered to be immoral in Roman society until about the beginning of the 5th century. By the beginning of the 5th century, the Romans had actually codified its permissibility in certain circumstances. Eusebius writes, even in his time, 100 years before this codification, that this slow introduction of leaving the most vulnerable in society open to death started to cause a coarsening or hardening in the hearts of men, that when the most vulnerable were left free to die, then all the other rights protecting the citizenry of the empire also began to erode. Now that makes sense. Now just think about that for a second, okay? Just philosophically, let's think about that for a second. If the weakest among us are totally susceptible to death, they have no rights, no one to fight for them, they can't fight for themselves. I mean, the person in the nursing home, sorry, cannot fight for them, cannot advocate for themselves, they cannot organize political action groups. And certainly the unborn, we know that, they can't do that for sure. I mean, that's definitely okay in play. Right, and all of my friends here from American Life League would understand that, right? That's why they have jobs, okay? Right, because the unborn don't have advocates. Part of why the group exists, okay? So, you see, when those two groups, the weakest in any society, now, why is that so contrary to just logic? If you think about it in general, law, by its nature, is intended to protect the weakest in a society. Law puts limits on the power of the most powerful. Right? So for example, even like speed limits, we say residential area 25, más o menos. Right? This is not a wink wink 25, okay? It is 25, okay? And you know, if you drive 30 and a 25, I mean, you could get pulled over for 30 and a 25. And there's a school zone. I mean, why do we have special school zones? Because we say the weakest in our midst are school children who are most vulnerable to traffic accidents and non-survival of traffic accidents. We have to even be more careful around them. I mean, we have that sense of us, even in our driving, our speed limits. Okay? Now, this article I just gave you is really the linchpin. It explains the linchpin about the church's understanding about abortion. Why? Because, see, there are two debates going on about abortion. One is, and this is an old debate which has been answered, When does life begin? Okay, that's a different question. Okay, that's biology. When does life begin? Biology. Sperm, egg, fusion, boom, it's life. Okay, that's biology. That's where the debate has to be. Okay? Because the other debate that is going on, which is similar but not the same, is not when does life begin, but rather when do we as a society put value on human life? See the difference? Because the first question, it can be answered scientifically and objectively, dispassionately, without any reference at all to politics, preference, or religion. You don't have to be a Catholic to know that when a sperm joins an egg, a life has begun. You see? But where the debate is now today, where it ought not to be, but it is no, when do you think life should have value? See the difference? It's a big difference. That's where we're having a problem, convincing the minds and hearts of Americans about why life should be protected from the moment of conception. Not when you think it has value, because you might not think it has value till it's born. But does that mean life has not begun? Not according to this doctor. See the difference? Okay. Now, I don't think, I hope I don't, and if I do, please raise your hand, okay? Or you can ask it in the question box if you're too afraid to ask it, to, you know, raise your hand in public about this. I don't think I have to convince too many people about the immorality of abortion. I mean, simply speaking, okay, it is the taking of a human life in the womb. Okay, it's a deliberate attack on the life in the womb. That's a basic definition I can give. Now, two questions that do come up, even among Catholics. What about rape and incest? All right? This just comes up all the time. Because you know what? Even if you talk to a lot of our pro-life politicians, they're anti-abortion, except in cases of rape or incest. Right? Most of them are, actually, I think. Would you say the ALL people agree with that? I mean, most of the pro-life politicians who are pro-life, they have an exception clause except for rape and incest. I mean, I don't know what percentage, but a lot of them are. And I, you know, they're otherwise champions of life, but, you know, there's this one area. You see, it's inconsistent to be pro-life except in instances of rape or incest. Because if it's a life, it's a life. If it's not, it's not. Right? So, does rape and incest change the answer to the question, when does life begin? No. Is it the baby's fault that it was created through rape? No. Or incest? No, it's not the baby's fault. Okay? So the question is, well then, does a woman have a right to repel her aggressor? Yes. Oh, so abortion's okay? No. So how do you do that? Okay. Do anyone want to know? Does anyone know? No? Okay. Bueller? No? Okay. All right. So, can a woman repel her aggressor? Yes. So, you mean, Father, she could have been raped and still take action to repel her aggressor? Yes. But I thought the church was anti-abortion or against abortion. Okay. Yes. Okay. See, do you see how people might say, well, these are not reconcilable positions? Okay. Yes, they are. Okay. So, here's what happens. A woman gets raped, she gets date raped, let's just say. Okay? It's more uncommon, unfortunately, than we fail to recognize, really, but date rape does happen a lot. Okay. So, Susan gets date raped. Okay? And she wakes up, maybe half drunk, you know, at 4 in the morning, realizing what has happened. Okay? She doesn't remember a lot of it, she passed out, she sees her clothes on the floor, she has a sense that, you know, that something's gone awry. Okay? She doesn't remember this being consensual. Okay? So she presumes rape. Okay. So, Susan can go to the ER. And she can say, I think I've been raped. Can I please be checked? Yes, you may. Okay? ER will do that. No problem. All right. So, one of the questions that the ER will ask, all right, is say, if you have been, what kind of protocols do you want us to take to make sure that you have not conceived? Right? That's what one of the questions I'll ask. Right? That's very standard. Okay, now, so the question is, can Susan take something called, like, for example, the morning after pill? It depends. Oh, it does. Okay, why? All right. If Susan has ovulated already that month, and how do you check that? Simple urinalysis. Heightened temperatures can already tell whether or not the woman has ovulated that month. If she has ovulated, she may not take the morning after pill, because there is a chance that she may have conceived. And taking the morning after pill would be the equivalent of a chemical abortion. If she has not ovulated that month, she may. See the difference? If there are no eggs in play, she may. All right? If there are eggs in play, she may not. Everyone clear on that? So, see how this is spun in the media? Church is anti-abortion. Okay? Church is against women. See, now it's all spun out of control. Now the church is anti-woman. Because the church is anti-abortion, the church is anti-woman. The church would never allow a woman to defend herself against the aggressor, the aggression of a rapist. Yes, she will, provided she can do so without jeopardizing a potential child. See the distinction? Okay? And this is done in Catholic hospitals all over the country, and in fact, in most places of the world. That's how they handle rape victims. Okay, question. Yes, well she can. She can licitly take it, because if she has not ovulated, she is not putting potential children at risk. If she has ovulated, then she may not, because she's already put the child, a potential child, at risk. We don't know if there's a child that's been conceived. Go ahead. Yep.
And so, by
hence the ovulation test. The ovulation, if it weren't for the ovulation test, we couldn't do that. But because you can do a simple ovulation test by urinalysis, you can do it. See what I'm saying? The missing link is the urinalysis. If you do not have ovulation certainty, then you cannot act against a potential child if you do not have certainty that there's no child there. It does sound like contraception, but it's one of those permitted practices. Yeah. And it doesn't contradict natural law. Oh, here's another reason why. Actually, one of the other effects of taking the morning after pill is not that, okay, but it's usually also taken in conjunction with chemical reactions associated with cleaning the woman out to kill all potential sperm. See? So in other words, the drug interaction from the morning after pill, okay, taken in conjunction with all of the other cleaning out procedures, the protocols, okay, these are medical procedures on a woman, okay, to clean her out after she has been attacked, okay, work together in order to ensure that a pregnancy does not occur, presuming she is unovulated. So the whole thing makes no sense unless she has not ovulated. Okay? Because the woman does retain a right to repel her aggressor. See what I'm saying? And what you're doing is you're balancing those two things out. Okay, I'm not going to get stuck on this now. I'll answer that in the Q&A. Okay? Because I got a bunch of other topics to cover. Okay, now, roll call. Jesse. Okay. Abigail. Kurt. Kimberly. Kay. Ruth. Crystal. Stacy, Tina,
here.
Jordan,
here.
Jonathan, okay, Marie,
here.
Morgan,
here.
George,
here.
Will,
here.
Michael,
here.
Brett,
here.
Fred,
here.
Okay, good. All right, we'll take this question up more later on because I don't want this to dominate conversation. Okay, let's move on to something else called euthanasia, but the other end of life. End of life decisions. Okay. I need to make a distinction between euthanasia and physician assisted suicide. Okay. Euthanasia. Now I'll tell you a funny story about this, which is the only funny thing about euthanasia. Euthanasia, okay? and then physician-assisted suicide. They're different, but very similar. Okay. When I was in the seminary, I had a classmate from Vietnam. And when we were taking our life issues classes, it's a series of them, we had to present to our classmates different papers. Okay, so it was like a white paper, a brief on the church's teaching, a summation of the tradition, and then some practical applications, okay? So he was a recent immigrant from Vietnam, so he was asked to write a paper on euthanasia, okay? Well, he had never heard the term euthanasia. So he came to me and said, what should I talk about regarding euthanasia? And I started describing the, I said, well, you know, the usual stuff. And he thought the teacher had asked him to speak about youth in Asia. Okay. And he's like, well, I can say, there's lots of things to be said. Like, you know, but it's only an hour class. I mean, there's going to be, you know, like, there can be a whole course about youth in Asia. And I said, oh, man. Oh, man. Okay. So I spelled it on the board. Oh. And he says, what's that? Okay. It's called mercy killing. Okay, now, what's the difference between euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide? Okay, euthanasia is not Dr. Kevorkian. That's different. He's physician-assisted suicide. Dr. Jack Kevorkian, remember him? Yeah. Did he convert or something like that? No? Because there was some, like Dr. Bernard Nathanson, he was an ex-abortionist who converted, but there are a few others now, but anyway, okay. All right, so euthanasia is the direct taking of a human life in either an elderly, vegetative, or incapacitated state in an attempt to either eliminate or reduce their suffering altogether, usually to eliminate altogether because you get into killing them. This is classically pulling the plug, okay? Right, that's it. I mean, it's just a direct attack. Or Terry Schiavo, okay, letting her starve to death. That's a direct attack. All right. Now, it doesn't have to be, I mean, it doesn't mean putting the pillow on her head, but it can just means letting her go. Okay, that also could be a form of taking life. Okay, because I mean starvation, essentially. All right. So at the end, right, didn't Terry Schiavo die eventually of complications associated with starvation? It wasn't because of her vegetative state. Okay, it was very sad. I mean, remember that? It was horrible. It was just horrible. Okay. Now, physician-assisted suicide is different. This is when a physician gives you drugs that will slowly kill you. So you're committing the suicide. The doctor is only helping you hasten that. See the difference? So at the end of the day, both of you have sins to answer for, but the doctor didn't kill you. You killed yourself. The doctor only gave you pills. You still had to make another act of the will to take them. Or they may not be pills, they may be injections, they're communicated to the body in any number of different ways. Okay? Okay, yes? What kind of pills? I'm not sure exactly what they give them, but they're pills that, let's say, the only, like, I'll give you a common one, only one I know of. If you have a heart condition, right, he can give you pills to raise your heart, which would kill you, eventually. Basically, if you have a weak heart, and then he gives you drugs to speed up your beat, eventually you have a heart attack. Okay? Or sleeping pills combined with certain alcohol. Okay? I mean, you know, that's how a lot of suicides do occur. Okay, the difference would be a physician actually wrote you a prescription for it, with the intent of you. Now, if a doctor wrote you a prescription for sleeping pills or antidepressants, with no knowledge that you wanted to kill yourself, he's not guilty of physician-assisted suicide. I mean, these antidepressants and these sleeping pills are prescribed all the time for various reasons, and it just so happens that you use it to kill yourself. Now, he's not, you know, he's not culpable for that, okay? Because obviously his intent was just to help you sleep or just to help you from being depressed. Do you see what I'm saying? You see how he's a little bit more removed from that. So, you know, that's a very important distinction because sometimes, you know, if I have doctors or nurses in the room, they get a little, you know, nurse practitioners are like, oh, well, Father, you know, I've helped give, you know, antidepressants before. I mean, you know, some of them are psychologists I've had in class and they're like, ooh, you know. No, you have to have actually intended to actually help the person die. Okay, now what's the whole What's the whole ethos behind this? Very simple, okay? The whole ethos is simply this. We, as a society, no longer put any value on the redemptive value of suffering. Okay? I mean, what is the first thing that many people say when someone dies? At least they're not suffering anymore. Okay, now let's parse that out for a second. Because on the one hand, there's a natural instinct to push ourselves away from suffering. I mean, no one wants to suffer. We understand that, right? But really, if you think about it with spiritual maturity, you can almost say, well, maybe it was a good thing they had a chance to suffer in this life, to make reparation for their sins, right? Maybe they got some time remitted for purgatory. They did it here. Maybe their suffering helped bring about charity in a family that led to conversions. See all the fruits that are coming out of this? See? But that takes spiritual maturity. So when people tell me, well, at least she's not suffering anymore, I try to help people understand that in a qualified way. I understand the natural aversion to suffering, but supernaturally, we can see the value to suffering. If we don't, we haven't spent enough time in front of a crucifix. Because it was precisely suffering and death that brought about our life. Right? And we look at the crucifix, you know, and we say these things, but when it really comes down to it, in a moment of, you know, sickness or, you know, disease in a family, for a lot of people, they're not spiritually mature persons of sufficient faith. All the stuff gets thrown out the window. What takes place? The place. Emotions. So there are huge family debates about things that could be settled by an advanced medical directive. You know what I'm talking about? An advanced medical directive. And if you have not written an advanced medical directive, we would like to write one. The diocese has one of the best ones in the country. We produced our own. So that you have legal protection to receive necessary nutrition and hydration in even a vegetative state. So that the state, and watch out past January 22, woo, okay, you know, you might be up for grabs if you get in an accident. Okay, so if you don't have an advanced medical directive, I'd write one ASAP. Takes all the burden off of your family and all the burden off your doctors. It has legal status. People have durable power of attorney. My last parents had lots of elderly people. We were writing them left and right. Okay, it's kind of funny though because, you know, they're like, this is going to be it, Father? You know, it's okay. All right. So the idea here is that an advanced medical directive respects the Catholic understanding of suffering and redemptive suffering, and then the human person's necessity to have even artificial nutrition and hydration. Artificial nutrition or hydration, otherwise known as ANH, is not considered extraordinary means of prolonging life. Using a ventilator is an extraordinary means of prolonging life. That's a breathing machine. Okay? Big difference. So, did Terry Schiavo die because of her mental condition? No. She was starved to death. She died of, you know, what, I'm sorry?
She was executed by the state.
Well, she wasn't, sort of passively. I wouldn't necessarily say the Grim Reaper walked in, you know, with the judge and hatcheted her. That wasn't what happened, but I understand what you mean. She was allowed to die. She was let go, basically. Okay? All right, so the idea here is that the whole church's teaching on extraordinary means of prolonging life respects nature's course. The disease should be the one responsible for killing the person, not the lack of nutrition and hydration. And a good way to understand this is think of babies. Babies rely on their parents, especially mom, for nutrition and hydration. Okay? Baby can't fend for himself. He just can't. All right? So, we give baby what they need. Okay? Now, why is this debate a little bit different on the other end of life? Well, their quality of life isn't so good anymore, and therefore we should take them out of their misery. That's very dangerous thinking, I hope you see. Because who's to say whose quality of life is better? That that's a very subjective standard when other people start deciding what your quality of life is. Like when courts and judges start deciding on that, uh-oh, if you don't like my lifestyle and you don't find me fit to live, I guess I'm up for grabs. You see the danger with that? Okay? So, what is the church's perennial teaching and belief in the dignity and sanctity of human life? Precious, right? Irrepeatable, right? And holy. So much so that the Son of God took on that precise humanity to redeem it. I mean, the incarnation should teach us everything about the sanctity of human life. God became man. If that doesn't make human existence holy by its own existence, then you don't know Jesus. See? So it's interesting, right? Because people say, well, Father, we shouldn't have these kinds of things inserted into our legal system because our legal system's not Christian or Catholic. It's Judeo-Christian. Sorry. It just is. Everything about our legal code is Judeo-Christian. We still agree that killing's wrong, right? Okay. That's, you know, now granted, that's not just unique to Judeo-Christian, but the whole notion of our whole legal system is based on Judeo-Christian principles, and then suddenly we just kick out the Christian part. Okay, fine, kick out the Christian part, you still have the Judeo part. Fifth commandment is from the Jews, not from the Catholics. See what I'm saying? So, it's interesting how we want to jettison religious speak or religious values coloring our legal system, yet our whole legal system is based in a religious notion about what is right and wrong. Even natural law. Okay. Now, so that's a distinction there. Let's talk about capital punishment. A lot of people like this one. Now, some years ago, there was a cardinal in the church named Cardinal Joseph Bernardin of the Archdiocese of Chicago. All right? And Cardinal Bernardin actually had a way of understanding all of these life issues in a very, very beautiful way that was unfortunately hijacked by certain elements in the church and turned it into meaning that some life issues, all life issues were equal. Okay, now let me just unpack that, all right? You might say, well, aren't all life issues equal? No, they're not, actually. Okay, not all life issues are equal. Abortion and contraception, especially those that have abortifacient effect, always take first place because we're dealing with innocent human life. Right? This is a tax on life against the innocent. Okay, now, let's talk about something, though, like capital punishment. You know, that's the old argument you sometimes hear, right? You might hear someone say, well, I'm anti-abortion, but I'm pro-capital punishment. Okay, and I say, why? I've never seen a fetus commit a mass murder. Okay, I understand, all right? But there's actually a lot more to it than that, all right? The church is unequivocally against capital punishment with some exceptions. All right? And I'm going to have to find this in here. In fact, Marie, I'm going to have you look this up for me. It's in this section here on capital punishment. It's on here on the Fifth Commandment. Oh, you got it? Oh, you can look it up in your own book. It's page 554, number 2299, somewhere around there. Okay? So here's a distinction. Let's take the mass murderer. Right? Or let's even more specific example. Let's take a gang leader in East LA. Yeah. Okay. All right. And I actually have a real example. All right. So let's take the gang leader in East LA. He's been responsible for organizing hits and murders of dozens of people, let's just say, over the course of, you know, several years. Okay? So he gets arrested, he gets tried, put in jail, and he's on death row. So, what's the church's teaching on capital punishment? Should he be given lethal injection? No. Okay? God is the giver and taker of all human life. A if you end someone's life prematurely, you are eliminating the possibility for that person's redemption and change and conversion before they die naturally. You see? In a way, you're saying that that person is beyond reform. Okay. When is capital punishment permitted? Capital punishment, according to the Catechism, Marie will find the point here, I'm sure, eventually, no pressure. Okay. Capital punishment is permitted in instances where the person incarcerated, either A, continues to remain an unrepentant danger to society, or B, the state cannot incarcerate known killers and convict it, assuming, of course, with due process. I'll give you an example of the latter. Let's say the state can incarcerate prisoners. When would this be true? Wartime. Good example. You've got lots of people, okay, been brought up on war crimes, have been tried in foreign courts, but by their own law, found guilty. Because of the destruction to the infrastructure, certain persons cannot be incarcerated. Who are the first ones that have to be eliminated? Those who committed capital crimes versus those who stole a loaf of bread. See the difference? Okay. Now, the Catechism also says, in the modern era, these instances are rare, if not non-existent. Interesting, isn't it? But it does, she does make an exception in those cases. If the state cannot protect the common good, because certain persons are still alive. I'll give another example. What if the person, it continues to be a threat from inside the jail? Do you think that's possible? I'll give you a real life example. About 3 or 4 years ago, there was a gang leader in East LA who went by the nickname Tukey. Okay? I don't know his real name, but his nickname was Tukey. Okay. Tukey started writing children's books, Christian children's books, in jail. And suddenly many actors and actresses from the Hollywood elite came to his defense saying, we should not have this man lethally injected because he has clearly shown repentance. Aha. Is that really what happened? Incidentally, Tukey could occasionally have visitors by phone across in the same facility, but not face-to-face, phone and video. Tukey, as it turns out, was in code language issuing hits on certain star witnesses in his appeals case. Suddenly, one by one, star witnesses started either disappearing or started dying. They traced the information and the order back to Tukey inside jail. Okay? This is the Crips and the Bloods. This is the kind of thing. Alright? Did Tukey remain a threat to the common good from inside? Yes. What did Governor Schwarzenegger do? Did he give him clemency? No. Tukey is dead. As we like to say in Spanish, se murió. He died. Okay? È morto. In Italian, he's dead. Alright. Now why? What is the number one good that the church says needs to be protected in these instances? The common good. The protection of civil, orderly society. See that? So, again, the need to render capital punishment, the Catechism reminds us, Marie, do you have it? What number is it? Well, let's see here. And our winner is... No. No, it's not. It ends with, is altogether, we'll find it one of these days. Okay, fine. Any questions about that so far? Capital punishment? Okay. So, the question then becomes, in practice, would be this. Can you be pro-capital punishment as a Catholic? Generally speaking, no. Unless in the circumstances so named. See what I'm saying? Now, so as a principle, no. You should not be for capital punishment. Unless you've got a Tukey situation, or the state clearly cannot incarcerate the prisoners. Okay, then, because then they're possibly running around out there somehow, or, you know, the chances of them escaping are so high that you kind of go back to square one, and the common good is at stake. But as a general principle, no. Yes?
Couldn't, in your particular case there...
Not my case. I didn't die. I knew anything.
The example you used is what I meant.
Yeah, okay. I'm just teasing. All right, go ahead. What's your question?
Couldn't the state have made the common good protected with less deaths and killings? I mean, couldn't allow to communicate?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, right. Does the state have the right to incarcerate someone in such a way that, now, okay, now...
No, but I meant from the church standpoint, capital punishment in that case, be benevolent.
Possibly. I suppose, possibly. But, okay, here's the problem, though, right? Is that the problem that's still, that you're still dealing with is that you're still dealing with provisions in the law, the civil law, which demand that the prisoner has a right to contact on the outside. Because then you start getting into things like cruel and unusual punishment. Because see, even solitary confinement isn't actually in the purest sense of the word solitary. I mean, they do have interaction with somebody. Okay? Now, what if that someone happens to be the guard who's on the payroll? Gives them a little code language, suddenly star witness is dead. Odd occurrence. Right? Now, granted, the state had the burden of proving that it went back to Tukey. Okay? So, in this particular instance, I mean, because, now, did the church say one way or the other whether or not Tukey should be executed? No, she actually never did. Didn't say yes or no. But the principle given would permit it.
Well, you remember the case of Susan Atkins, which is the other example.
Okay, hold that thought for a second, because I can't get into, I mean, I still have one more topic to cover. I'm already at time. Okay, listen to this, okay? 2266 and 2267. This is what the church teaches here. Alright, now. Alright. Assuming that the guilty party's identity and responsibility have been fully determined, the traditional teaching of the church does not exclude recourse to the death penalty if this is the only possible way of effectively defending human lives against the unjust aggressor. Okay, do you think of that war example? That works. If, however, non-lethal means are sufficient to defend and protect people's safety from the aggressor, authority will limit itself to such means, okay, like solitary is a good example, as these are more in keeping with the concrete conditions of the common good and more in conformity with the dignity of the human person. Okay? Brazen as they may be, unreformable in your mind as they may be, they still have human dignity. Okay? All right, now listen, this is the last paragraph. Today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime by rendering one who has committed an offense incapable of doing harm without definitively taking away from him the possibility of redeeming himself, the cases in which the execution of the offender is an absolute necessity are very rare, if practically non-existent. See that? So, what it's saying here is that capital punishment is not intrinsically evil. There are instances when it can be used, but they are rare, not as a rule. I think that's probably the best way to put it. So it doesn't meet the same litmus test as abortion, which is never permitted. See? Capital punishment can be. Okay, now, last one, the war. I know all the military guys are hungering for this one. The war. Okay. It's very important. All right, now, I'll talk about this for just a few minutes. All right, just war theory. All right, let's back up in history. 5th century, Augustine of Hippo, the great Saint Augustine. He's living in North Africa. Week after week, year after year, he is seeing Catholic populations and towns being decimated, murdered, and marauded by barbarians, by fomenting Islam, okay, and different factors. The church teaches, thou shall not kill. She further teaches in our Lord, if your enemy strikes you on your right, give him your left. Okay? So what's Augustine's question? Well, it's clear what the gospel teaches. But if we keep this up, there ain't going to be anyone to spread the gospel. Right? We'll all be dead. And we can't pray the Our Father. Because thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. On earth ain't going to happen. It's gone. So, the question was, is it possible for us to engage in war in a just way so that we are defending the common good? So that we have a chance of survival? See what I'm saying? It's a fair question, right? Okay. So, then, in the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas, the great Dominican, further augments the teaching. Augustine had his criteria, Aquinas took them and added some. Now, here's the problem. Back in Augustine's day and Thomas Aquinas' time, they were dealing with what's called conventional warfare. We're talking about swords, clubs, bows and arrows. Okay? And I don't know, you military guys could tell me, in the 13th century, did they have guns? Not yet, but the 13th century? No? Not like muskets, not even? Not quite yet, right? Still bow and arrow, I think, right? Joan of Arc, bow and arrow? I mean, Joan of Arc wasn't carrying a rifle around. That'd be funny to see, but she wasn't. Okay? All right. So they're dealing with really conventional warfare. Okay? No weapons of mass destruction available during the time of Aquinas and Augustine. Now, here's a problem. The third iteration of the just war theory. Now we have something called nuclear weapons, dirty bombs, chemical weapons, the capacity to cause the extermination of millions of lives, actually, right? With the amount of stuff we got in the world today, quite possible. If we all blew it all up at once, we'd be in big trouble, okay? So, what the church is hoping, at least some of us in the church is hoping, I should say, is that Pope Benedict XVI, probably one of the most brilliant minds in the church ever, and that's saying a lot, will come up with another iteration of the just war theory to make provisions for preemptive strikes. See that? See the problem? If we don't take action before we're hit, we will never be able to take action at all. Aquinas and Augustine were always dealing with reaction to an assault. Never aggression for its own sake to conquer, but always a response to aggression from the outside. You see the problem? You can't do that with weapons of mass destruction. Because if you wait too long, I mean, isn't this the debate in the country, right? Should we have gone? Should we not have gone? Did he really have the weapon? You know, all these questions that came up, right? Okay, it's all predicated on this whole question, whether or not, okay, we had the right to go in. And by the way, I should mention this. The Bush administration, just so you know this, consulted heavily with the Vatican before going to Afghanistan and going to Iraq. Now, mind you, when we went to Afghanistan, no one seemed to really say, oh, that's not right. Because that was a response to 9/11, they said, right? But we went to Iraq, some people said it was a response to 9/11, others said it wasn't. Some said it's Bush's private war, others said, no, it's a continuation of defiance of the UN treaty signed in the first Gulf War that Hussein never followed. Okay. Now, let us be clear on one thing before I mention the principles. As a Catholic, you are free to agree or disagree on the justice of any given war. The Church herself never makes official pronouncements on the justice of any particular war. Now, I'll give you an example of how this kind of got muddled a little bit in this most current war we're in with the comments of Pope John Paul II of happy memory. Pope John Paul II said something that practically every pope has said, but of course the media coverage is different these days than it was in the time, let's say, of Pope Pius XII's time. He said, war is always a defeat for the human family. Now, who would disagree with that? War is always a defeat for the human family. What he's saying is, if we must resort to this, is there another way we can settle these questions without fighting? It's a fair question. Okay, now, how does the media interpret it? Headlines, Church condemns war. No. John Paul II was speaking private opinion. Don't forget, he authored what I'm about to teach you. Okay? He wouldn't contradict what I'm about to teach you. Because this is what he wrote. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, 1983. Part of his pontificate. Okay. So, cult did not teach that the church says this war is unjust. He says, I think it is unjust. That is my private opinion. Now, this became a very important question. My first parish assignment was in Vienna, Virginia. A lot of Pentagon brass. I mean, a lot of Pentagon brass. Okay? The moment the Pope said this, oh my gosh, the phone line started ringing. Okay, I mean, I felt like I was a radio talk show host, and I said something controversial on the air, and boom, everyone started calling, okay? Okay, so what was the question? Father, if the Pope is against the war, does it mean the church is? Should I understand this as one and the same? And if the church is against the war, as a member of the armed forces and a Catholic, must I remove myself from military duty because I cannot participate in this under conscience? Good question, don't you think? Okay, all right. So, very adeptly, Archbishop Edwin O'Brien, Archbishop of the Military Archdiocese of the United States, sent a dubium to Rome, which is a doubt. Okay, it's not that he has a doubt, but he wants to ask a question. It's a question to the Holy Father. The response was immediate. The question was this: must Americans who are Catholics, because of the statements made by Pope John Paul II, remove themselves from military service or take a conscientious objection to participation in the current war? That's a question. Answer, no. John Paul was speaking on his own person, not teaching from the See of Peter. Answer, salt. So, as a Catholic, are you free to disagree with the war? Sure. Do you think the war is just? Sure. The church is not teaching the justice of any particular war. She is enunciating the principles that need to be considered when deciding whether or not to go to war in the first place. See the distinction? There's a very, very important difference because, see, I think what some Catholics are waiting for the church to do in any given war is to pray referee. Good, no good. You know, it's like, you know. No, that's not the church's job. She's to enunciate the principles of work. So here are the principles. If you military fellows and others want to take this down, I'm sure you'd like to have this handy. In your catechisms, number 2309, you can look it up online, number 2309, just war theory. Number one, the strict conditions for legitimate defense, again, legitimate defense, by military force require rigorous consideration. The gravity of such a decision makes it subject to rigorous conditions of moral legitimacy. And so, at one and the same time, number one, the damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. Okay? So let's say just in a practical point, okay? The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. So, let's just think about the Iraq War. Okay? Now, again, it depends how you're understanding this, right? Because if you're understanding the Iraq War as a continuation of the policy against 9/11 and the terrorists, and Saddam is a terrorist, okay? Then you have one way of understanding that. If you don't think it's related to 9/11, then you have a different way of understanding it. I mean, here's the debate. Okay? So, the 9/11, pretty clear. The damage inflicted by the aggressor, i.e. Al-Qaeda, on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. Yeah, pretty grave. Pretty certain, pretty lasting. Nearly 3,000 dead people is pretty lasting. Okay? All right. Was that true in Iraq? Okay, I don't know. All right. Next. All other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. So let's think about the UN resolutions. Okay, Al-Qaeda isn't represented in the UN. That's a whole other spin on these wars, right? Because now we're dealing with non-nation combatants. So, Hussein, he did defy all of the UN resolutions. I mean, he was shooting at our planes and NATO planes flying through the no-fly zone repeatedly, over and over and over again. Okay? The UN resolutions, I think, could be argued fairly clearly that they were not effective. Okay. Three, there must be a serious prospect of success. In other words, don't start something you can't finish. Now, initially, when the president landed on the aircraft carrier, we thought we were in good shape, right? I mean, do you military guys think we were in good shape at that point? I don't know. I mean, I know the public did. Who are the military guys? Raise your hands. Or even with military backgrounds, even if you're not active right now. Does anyone want to say, do you think, that, I mean, by that point, do you think we were good? I mean, the media led us to believe we were good. Okay, now, what's that?
Never believe the media.
Well, okay, I know. That's a different class. Okay, but, all right, I understand that. But, okay, lay people who are non-military, civilians, raise your hand. Did you think we were good? Hey, mission accomplished, right? Wasn't that what the thing said? Mission accomplished? Man, it was a great staged event. Okay. So, I don't know. All right, there it is. All right. Now, next. The use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition. I'll say it again. The use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. Okay, now, lots of casualties in Iraq. Okay, do we balance that against the number of Kurds killed? Gassed by Hussein? Okay, this is, again, see what the church is doing? Here are the principles, you've got to apply them. All right, now there are a few others here. You cannot go after non-combatants. Only, now, why is that a problem? Because a lot of the combatants don't look like soldiers.
How about Hamas in Israel right now?
Well, hold on. That's not... That's a whole other class, okay? I'm just trying to stick with one war. I'm having trouble with this one war, okay? Don't, okay? But, I mean, I had a parishioner in my last assignment, all right? They had his infantry, army, doing patrols, right? Okay. Door to doors and, you know, doing patrols on the streets. Okay. They put out advance notice. Do no children, even children, may run up to soldiers. Children must be kept at bay. Why? Because they had incidents where children were strapped with plastic explosives and ran into a whole unit, blew up and killed 8 guys in the army. All right? They were in situations where they had to kill children. Okay? Horrible, isn't it? I mean, that's just terrible. I mean, this former parishioner of mine, to this day, has nightmares about it because he has a son the age of a boy he shot. But he had to protect his men. They gave advance warning, okay, that children were not to become, under any circumstance. You know, it's a very tense area. See how horrible this is? I mean, I don't care what you think about the war. That example is horrible. That's a horrible situation to be in. Okay. Now, the other thing, too, is the last point here. The evaluation of these conditions for moral legitimacy belongs to the prudential judgment of those who have responsibility for the common good. What does that mean? The legitimate governments of these soldiers have the prudential judgment at their fingertips. This is where the church says it is not our job to say that the war is just or unjust. You see that? Now, do you see why Pope John Paul II's comments, while zealous and I'm sure well-intending to try to prevent bloodshed, caused a lot of confusion? They did. So much so that Archbishop O'Brien, who's now the Archbishop of Baltimore, had to send a question to Rome whether or not Catholics in the military had to excuse themselves. Okay? Okay. All right. Now, I'm going to take a break, and then you can all ask me all the questions you like. If you owe me paperwork, please bring it forward. And did Jonathan McGuire come at last? No? Okay, I think he was gone. Okay. We'll see you next week. For those of you who want to stay, you can. And in the question box, Joan is where? Up front. Hold on.
You shouldn't say Abigail's name about the initiation.
No, but I meant to.
You did mean to.
I mean to. Yep, she's highlighted. She's fine.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as long as it's all our other paperwork combined. I mean, all things being equal. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Abigail.
Father, can I get a certificate at the end of the session that I attended this?
For what?
Me? Just for
no.
Record? No?
No, Father McGahn's classes have no credibility in the world.
Okay.
I don't have, sorry. Yeah, I guess so, sure.
Do you want to read them more?
Yeah, let me read them. I mean, we still have a week, right? Yeah, okay. Sir.
I need a sheet for what I need to get back.
There you go.
As well as, I won't be making it to that because I'm PCSing. I'll be gone before.
Okay, good.
Brett.
Tell me your name again.
Brett.
Ringgold.
So I was wanting to know what I need to do because it's...
Oh, you don't have to go. It's totally optional.
I'm saying, because I'm still trying to come into the church, but I'll be out of this area completely.
Oh, talk to Father DiMartino, because he's doing your prep, right? Isn't marriage? No? Oh. Okay, send me an email. Do you know my email?
No.
Okay, come here. It's really easy. I'll have to look at your file, but I couldn't tell you right now.
Should I just call?
Well, yeah, but email's better. Because what the secretary's going to tell you is email me. Pretty easy? All right. Yes, ma'am. Okay, very good. Thank you. How are you?
Good.
Okay, I'll put that in your file.
And then Brett needs a letter, too, from the church.
Yeah. He needs to call and ask for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Professor Mike, do
that's
I
right.
need to go stop and get a letter?
Yes, you do.
I have to go.
Yep,
to the
you do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
Thanks, Stacy. Yep, got it.
Remember Father Berrigan? Did you ever hear about him?
Who?
Father Berrigan?
Mm-mm. Thank you.
When you mentioned the
Marie Christine.
She doesn't have anything yet, but
okay.
That's what I need to give you.
Okay, for now. Yep. Okay. Cool. Thanks. God bless you. Have a good day. Night.
During the Vietnam War in Chicago, Father Berrigan was a pastor of one of the priests of one of the parishes there, and he was a big anti-war protester. That's when they started with this Catholic, can you go to war, not go to war.
Mm.
Real big about it. And then I got into was. I don't know, it wasn't John Paul, but it was whoever the Pope was then.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
In what year? Vietnam?
78, 68.
Paul the Sixth.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
That's when they started with this thing about Catholics can't go to war. And
yes.
Trying to...
Yes. No, it's an interesting question, isn't it?
It is.
God bless. See you later. Good questions. All right, children, let's pick it up. That way I can get home and in bed. I have not been home today since I left. This is against the natural law. Okay. By the way, this is an excellent article. I mean, I hope you read it. It is so well written, and it is so dispassionate. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know that this woman is pro-life, because the point of the article is to show you that this is not whether or not I'm pro-life or pro-choice. Is just simply biologically, as a scientist, I can tell you when life begins. Now, if that's true, then what do we say from there? See, but she says that the debate is not on when life begins, the debate is when we give life value, which could be in two entirely different answers. So someone might say, yes, life does begin at conception, but doesn't have rights until the third trimester. See that? So, excellent article. I'm really glad I read it. Something to say, magazines come in and out, and I don't read every article. I don't know who does, but I can't read everything. Okay. Now, let me take two questions from last time that got buried under. Oh, maybe there's some nervous persons here who asked them. Okay. If we eat meat on Fridays and don't perform a mortification, what type of sin are we in? Classic. This is a Catholic asking, I can tell. Okay, that's how Catholics ask questions. Non-Catholic, well, you know, just trying to be a good person, you know. It's just easier to answer, okay? But this is like, the Catholic always has a sense of the punitive. You know, like, oh, I'm going to get in trouble. Okay. All right, now, let's talk about something called ignorance. Okay? That's why one of my favorite books is Catholicism for Dummies. An excellent book. Let's talk about ignorance. There are two kinds of ignorance in general. Invincible, which is culpable, and invincible, which is non-culpable. Okay, now, what's the difference? If you didn't know about the meat on Fridays thing and could not have reasonably been expected to know it, either because you had never heard it or B, it had never been taught to you or preached. And believe you me, when's the last time you heard a priest talk about meat on Fridays? Okay? I mean, even I, in my brazen nature, will not do that. Okay? Now, I might this year, though, because everyone's getting excited. Okay. So, if you didn't know, but could not have reasonably been expected to know, the church does not require the impossible. Therefore, you are invincibly ignorant, non-culpable. However, if you didn't know, but you should have known, then you're guilty. You're culpable. Now, I'll give you an example. Speed limit. The judge will always tell you in traffic court. Now, no one has asked me why I know so much about traffic court. But the judge will always tell you in traffic court. Okay? I know some people who should though. Okay. The judge, if you tell the judge, "Judge, I didn't know it was 25. Tough munchies. You should have known it was 25. It's posted. And when's the last time you saw it be 45 in a residential area anyway? See? Okay. Meet on Fridays? Some know, some don't know. Spread the word. Okay? That's all I can say. Anyone, any follow-ups to that question, just as a principle? All right, friends, I knew it. All right. Okay, if it's eggs or like ranch dressing with bacon bits, but it's not natural meat. It's like processed. Gravy. Oh, another one. Gravy. You got me on the gravy question. Good. All right.
Now, my kids have argued in the past that
the Lenten ones are, yes. Precisely why it's invincible ignorance. Because the way that it's been taught has led people to believe that outside of Lent, we don't follow it. Yes, ma'am. That's why I'm saying there are two kinds of ignorance. See? Okay. So I don't have to tell you who's right and who's wrong. I'm just telling you, there are two kinds of ignorance. Figure it out. Okay? Yeah, they're like, I just learned that today. Now, there are those of you who are like, la, 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 la. I don't want to hear that. I still like my steak on Fridays. La, 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 la. Now, if you want to eat meat on Fridays outside of Lent, fine. But spend more time in prayer, perform a corporal or spiritual work of mercy, or give up something else. Like, for example, one of my buddies, he doesn't really care or not care for steak. It ain't. You know? But, boy, a cold, tall, cold one after work on Friday. Again, that's his mortification. That's what he gives up on Friday. See what I'm saying? The steak thing, so what are the kids? The kids don't have dessert on Friday. Okay? So, you know, maybe diet-wise, they want their protein, but they don't really need the fat and cholesterol of ice cream. Okay. Does it have health benefits? Well, in this instance, yes. Okay. Enough about that. Sorry there, John. Okay. Next question. If a person is baptized, communion, okay, I'm assuming Holy Communion, First Communion. If a person has been baptized, received First Holy Communion, and made First Penance, can they still take communion at Mass? Yeah. But they're not married in the church. No. They can't. If they're not married in the church, married by law, civilly, but not by the church. No, they can't. Does anyone have any questions about that? And do you know why that is? I hope this is clear. The question basically, that whole convoluted mess I just read, okay, is simply this. If you are not married in the church, but you're Catholic, right? But you've received all your sacraments, but you didn't marry in the church, but you're Catholic. If you're not married in the church, can you go to communion or confession? No. Except one case. If you are living with your spouse as brother and sister, and scandal is averted. Now, give an example. Okay. Let's say, does anyone want to be a volunteer couple? You I like to have, there we go. All right, there we go. Jimmy Cathy. All right. Hopefully we'll still be on good terms after this. Okay. So Jim and Kathy are both Catholics, but they just decided in the summer of 1967 to just get married and the heck with the church. Okay. Now, what about the children? Are they legitimate or not? They are. Okay? First question everyone had worried about. Because anytime I deal with an annulment, what about my kids? Don't worry. Okay. But they always ask that. Okay? All right. So, Jim and Kathy can't go to communion or confession if they're living together as husband and wife. Why? Because in order to, first of all, they're not married, so their sex is not marital, it's fornication. Plain and simple. Got that? Alright, now, why can't they go to confession? Because to make an integral confession, you need to have sins to confess, sorrow for your sins, and a firm purpose of amendment not to sin again. So, yep, they got sins, yeah, they're sorry, but are they going to continue living as husband and wife? Yeah. Okay, then they don't really have a firm purpose of amendment not to sin again. They're going to go back to fornication. So that's why they can't go to communion. That's why they can't go to confession. Is that pretty clear? Okay, that's all I have. Next. Oh, all right.
I don't know how to word
this. That's okay, Joan. You won't offend me. I mean, you might, but it's okay. I won't tell you, you will.
I don't even know how to word it.
All right.
It's on
top. Okay. Hold on. Capital punishment is not a sin if it meets the criteria that I mentioned.
Yes.
Okay. Let's say it doesn't. The state.
The state.
Yeah.
No.
Or the officials.
Okay.
Okay, now, then we get into the whole notion of cooperation.
Yes.
Ah. See, Joan, you are always on the cutting edge. I love it. Okay, you are totally, Joan, you're always asking the right questions.
No.
Okay. All right, Joan. Extra points for you out of purgatory. Not that I have the right to determine that, but just, you know, it's a nice consolation prize. Okay. Now, cooperation. All right. See, isn't this fun? Okay. There are two kinds of cooperation. There's material cooperation, and let's see, material is remote and proximate. Okay. And then there's formal cooperation. All right. That's the difference. Okay. Let's talk about formal cooperation first. That's easy. Formal cooperation is cooperating in an evil where your help is indispensable and your intent is to commit the evil or to aid it. Okay. I'll give you an example. You are a nurse who works in a Planned Parenthood abortion mill. Okay? You make a paycheck based on abortions being performed. Right? All right. Or you're an abortionist. You're performing the abortion. You are a formal cooperator with evil. You may not do that. Right? That should be fairly clear. Your help is indispensable, and you share in the intent. Okay? All right, now, let's get into the hazy stuff, which is, of course, what everyone wants to talk about and gives me a job, at least on Wednesday nights. Okay, so remote cooperation is that your help is part of the act, but it is so far removed, and you do not share in the intent. Okay, it is permitted. For example, if you buy Häagen-Dazs ice cream, and Häagen-Dazs ice cream gives to Planned Parenthood, did you know the whole shopping thing? Made in China, the boycott list? Are you bound to boycott? No. You're not bound to boycott, but you may. And I think that's a very effective way of being disciplined and mortifying yourself and being in solidarity with the unborn. Are you bound to boycott? No. Because that's remote material cooperation. Catholics may participate remotely. Now, they may, but must they or should they? That's a judgment call, prudential judgment. Okay? Now, I would just say this today. It is nearly impossible to buy goods in the market without having some cooperation with abortion. It's almost impossible. I mean, every time you think you've gotten steer clear of every single nook and cranny, oh man, guess who sits on the board of that board and that, oh boy, okay? It's almost impossible, all right? So I tell Catholics you should not have a qualm of conscience about that, because it is an impossibility. The church does not require the impossible, by the way. Okay, now, proximate, all right? You do not necessarily share in the intent, but your help is so indispensable that the person may not be able to carry it out. Okay, you drive cabs in Washington, D.C. That's my hometown, okay? And a cab driver says, I'm looking for a date. Okay, so you're the cabbie, right? Take me to 14th Street. Okay, how far can the cabbie go? He can, not up 14th Street, because he starts getting into this. He's not committing a sin of fornication with a prostitute, okay? But he can't, he's not quite here either. His help is indispensable, because he's driving the guy to the place. But, hold on, let me finish my explanation, okay? His help is not indispensable, it's indispensable at this point, because he's the one providing the ride. But he doesn't share in the intent. In fact, as a good Catholic, he says, this son of a gun, you know, what a creep. So what does he do? He drops him off several blocks from where he wants to be. And he says, where is it? Have a good night, sir. Now what if he says, that way? Okay, he might be able to do that. That's a little hazy. Now, I have to ask him, why did you do that? Well, he asked me a question. I didn't want to lie. Okay, well, he asked me, which way is it? Well, if I said in any other way but the right way, it'd be a lie, and I didn't want to lie. Okay, and if I said, Father, if I had lied, would that be culpable? Less so. So lying's good? Nope. Less culpable. Remember we talked about that last time? The Hitler and the stormtrooper and the Nazi, remember? I said, not that lying's good, it's just less culpable. All right. Okay, yes. All right. Okay, hold on. Hold on, John.
I was just going to ask another scenario, but we could be now. Like,
yeah, I know, Marie. Okay, that's how you bring me more cookies. Okay, now. All right, yes.
Just get back to what Joan was talking about, the hang-up on capital punishment aspect of cooperation.
Yeah, okay, yeah, right.
All right.
Let's get back to that.
Sure.
Hey, something's, the jury's one part of it. Let's just say we actually had a Catholic governor of a state where we have capital punishment.
Yeah.
It would be a material aspect of not putting a stay of execution on everybody.
Yeah. No. Formal.
Formal.
See, the governor, because he can put a stay,
right,
is uniquely positioned to stop it.
He's not going to last long.
I know.
So, you know, the...
That doesn't matter.
Saving lives is saving lives.
Right. Oh, okay. Now, okay. Now, what you're getting into, that's a very interesting question, which is what's called proportionalism. Is the good I would do by staying in office and letting this scumbucket fry outweigh? Now, you can't do that.
Right. But I'm also losing, I would sacrifice the gains I've made in pro-life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, because I don't think he's anti-abortion, he's really protected the state. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but you can't do that?
No, you can't be involved in that. Because you're cooperating in something that is anti-life.
Okay, so there's no real good, I don't have a good answer.
Well, I'll tell you why the reason's confusing. I mean, why the explanation's confusing to people, because it's emotional here. Now, let's just try to be non-emotive about this for a second. Because we see the nobility of protecting the unborn, we don't see the nobility of protecting the scumbucket. You see that? That's really what it comes down to. Because what we're saying now then is that life is more precious than that life. That's what it comes down to. Based on what he's done. The rapist and the arsonist, okay, and the pedophile, he needs to die. Okay? But the unborn, no way. Okay, now, I would just say this. I'm not the man's judge. Right? And none of us are. Okay? Now, if the man decided to prevent stays, okay, because he really thought that he was doing good by by staying in office to protect the unborn. Do I understand where he's coming from? Yes. On an emotive level, do I agree with him? Yes. But I'm not talking about the emotive here. I'm just talking about principles. And this is the hardest thing about these issues. You do have to be somewhat emotionally detached and think about these things dispassionately. Now, that's a tough question. It's a great question because, you know, that's actually a doctoral dissertation, okay? Because the question would be, what is his cooperation? That's really what the thesis would be about. What level of cooperation? Well, a governor is formal. He has to be formal because he's the only guy who can prevent it. He's the only guy who can prevent it. Unless someone stepped forward and said, no, I did it. Highly unlikely, right? That ain't going to happen.
But the process, the way it works, of course, doesn't make it culpable.
No. Well, this is a very difficult question. I don't know if I have an answer for that right away.
I'll think on it.
Yeah, I think I have to think on that a little bit more. But I would just say on first glance, because of this is why legislators, in terms of abortion, have a much higher culpability than just the average citizen. Because the legislator can actually pull the trigger. The population may give him the gun and the bullets, but the legislator has to pull the trigger.
That's what I love the way Joan phrased the question from the center.
You're right. No. Right. That's good. Former Protestant. She's getting the hang of it. Okay. All right. Good for you, Joan. Okay. So, my read?
Yeah.
That's the governor. He's the only guy who can stop it. All right. Now, does that ride well with his party? No. Does it ride well with the NRA? No. Does it ride well with a lot of pro-life groups? No, actually. Believe it or not. Okay. The pro-life groups actually would say capital punishment, yes. Abortion, no. Contraception, yes. Abortion, no. See, the church is trying to teach this whole thing which Cardinal Bernardine had in mind, which is the seamless garment. Pro-life all the way. Now, capital punishment does have exceptions. War is not intrinsically evil, because clearly there are instances when we can have war and fight it justly. See? So the people who tell me war is intrinsically evil and capital punishment is intrinsically evil haven't read this. They have not. See that? So the big mistake that people do make is that they put abortion on par with capital punishment and just war. You cannot do that. That doesn't even make sense. See that? Okay, Frances. That's a great question, though. Joan, you guys should have your own talk show. Okay. Frances? Say it again,
With our lawmakers concerning abortion, that's specific. When we cooperate, well, the cooperation through the vote, that would be approximate.
Say it again? Voting?
Voting.
For pro-abortion candidates?
Yes.
Now, I would actually put approximate material. Catholics may not participate in this or that.
So, that's
it. Yeah. So what's your question?
So, to vote for Obama, in other words, would be considered approximate.
Okay. We'll see. All right. This is a great question. I should probably turn on the recorder for this one. Okay. No, I don't have to win this one because the bishop is totally on board with this. So, and even if they weren't, it's okay. What are they going to do? Send me to Colonial Beach? They already did that. Okay, now. It's like, what are you going to do? Fire me? You can't fire me. Okay. Huh? Let's listen to this for a second, okay? Just listen to the line of thought. I'm not advocating it. I'm just presenting it, all right? So don't start throwing things at me, all right? This is just listen to what I've heard this said. Father, I am pro-life. That's why I voted for Obama. Okay, now let's listen to that, right? Okay, now why? Okay, all right. Well, strange, but okay. Let me hear you out. I mean, I'll listen to the argument. What do you say? Okay, Father, abortion occurrences happen more when there's higher poverty. Obama is more interested in the alleviation of poverty. Ergo, the alleviation of abortion. Actually, Father, by voting for Obama, we will be decreasing abortion. Okay, now, do you hear that? All right, Marie, you got that?
I've heard it.
All right, Marie works at ALL. She's got it. Okay, now, the problem is this. Now, that might work in a vacuum, okay? we would only need to go across the ocean to Europe to see whether or not that's actually worked out. Did the relaxing of abortion laws in Europe decrease or increase abortion even when prosperity went up? See? Anytime you decrease abortion regulations, abortion always increases irrespective of the financial situation of the market. See that? Okay. But do you see how the argument I just presented by this person who's making their case can sound oh so compelling? Ah.
Okay.
True. Or you could say, the richer I get, the more kids I can have. Right. See what I'm saying? I mean, so the problem here is this. The argument that this person is making is not logic. It's emotive. Okay. That's what I'm trying to get us away from. Because you see, why do priests get called to help a family decide whether or not to remove the breathing machine from Uncle Jerry? Because Father isn't related to Uncle Jerry, and God willing, he's a man of prayer and truth who can talk about Uncle Jerry without the emotions of who Uncle Jerry is to him. Does that mean we're cold and unfeeling? No, I mean, this is a son of God. This is a soul that God died for on the cross. We want the best for him, but we also have to respect the created order and the fact that this man is dying. You see that? Okay. But if you're Uncle Jerry's son, or daughter, or wife, can you honestly make that deliberation dispassionately? No. And I wouldn't expect you to either. That's why we get called in to answer these questions. Now, are they hard questions to answer? Yes, they're always hard. Always hard. Don't trust me. I lose sleep over counsel I've given. I know it was right. I consulted with two other priests whose value judgment I trust, but it was still hard. Okay? But I had to give them the hard truth. Not what I like to do, but I have to do it. See what I'm saying? Okay. This is one of the great benefits of being celibate, by the way. Okay. Like, see, my mom wrote her advanced medical directive. So, who's the power of attorney? Me. My mom wanted to make it my sister. I just said, heck no. Mom, I could not. I could not. Your son is cold and heartless. He could. Yeah, little sister of mine. Okay, she said, your son is cold and heartless. He could. No, actually, what my sister meant to say, I think, is that... Well, anyway. All right. Later. Question? Do you have a question? No, okay. May I ask the next one? Okay. Oh, okay. Wait, is this related to what we're talking about? Okay, good. There's no cutting in line. Okay, all right. All right. Go ahead, Kathy. All right, speak up, Kathy.
A lot of people who are terminal, and so that's okay, right?
That's not suicide, right? No. No, morphine's not suicidal. So morphine's palliative care. It's standard palliative care. It's pain reducing. It's okay.
So there's no
real
point that you have to worry about.
Generally, no. There are exceptions to that, though.
Okay, so
yeah, Advanced Medical Directive, AMD.
Okay, is it possible...
No, you cannot will your own demise.
Okay, so I can't
will the Advanced Medical Directive, Kathy, you know what this is like? This is like Teresa of Avila. Teresa of Avila wanted to die as a martyr. She wanted to die, she had this deep desire to die as a martyr. So did her brother, her little brother. So they heard the Moors were coming. The Moors are the Muslims, right? From North Africa. They came across the Iberian Peninsula, the Straits of Gibraltar, and they went across and they started ransacking Spain. Well, they're coming to Avila, and they're going to try to seize the town. Well, Teresa of Avila, okay, the future doctor of the church, okay, and one of the most influential saints of the late Middle Ages, decided that she wanted to be a martyr. Why? Because she'd go straight to heaven. So what did she do? She and her brother snuck out of the city walls in the middle of the night, and they sat on a bluff waiting for the Muslims to come and cut their heads off. Guess what happened? The Moors came from the other direction, totally missed Teresa and her brother, and her uncle went out there, tied them by the neck with rope, and dragged them back into the city and lock them up until the siege was over. Okay, Teresa later regretted that because she thought she was being heroic, right? She wouldn't have been giving witness to anything. She would just have been a casualty of war. You see what I'm saying? Okay, that wasn't really a wit. That wasn't really a martyrdom. That was being stupid. See what I'm saying? I mean, with martyrdom, there has to be some directed. So, same thing. Okay? Oh, no, no, no. But you want purgatory time done here, so you want Jim to reduce you down to my size. Okay? No, you cannot will your own demise. But you're becoming God. All right? You're playing God. Yeah. And Jim can't do it. Jim wouldn't do it, and you can't make him. I mean, it's like, you know, the biggest joke in the diocese for priests is your requests for music and the liturgy at your funeral. Well, what if they don't honor it? What are they going to do? Yeah. Right? I mean, you're dead. What do you even know about it? You can't protest that. Okay, it's out of my hands. All right. I mean, they make us fill out this form, but I mean, I'm like, whatever. So I just because this is crazy, I put down, you know, my music, Kumbaya, and Where Your Children of the World Stole, and, you know, bring all the children around the altar, the whole thing, you know, and just crazy liturgy, because they probably are not going to read it anyway. Okay, but anyway, all right. So, did I answer your question? You cannot will your own demise. Now, let me just talk about artificial nutrition and hydration for a second. Very important topic, because this is something that could really face us all. I had a terrible situation when I was my second assignment. Oh, my God, I hope she doesn't hold it against me. Cecilia McDowell was one of my parishioners, and it was right at about the time of Terry Schiavo. All right? I mean, almost the same time, maybe a month after. And Cecilia became prey to hospice care in the nursing home. You've got to be careful with hospice care. You've got to be really careful with hospice care. If you do not know who they are and what their operating principles are, they might starve you to death. Okay? Because they have an economic model they need to meet to be profitable. And they justify their method because they say, well, at least we're helping them die with dignity. That's not good. Because what's dying with dignity mean to you? Right? Okay, that means quality of life. That's what that means. Your quality of life is not good enough. All right, so they basically dehydrated her to death. Now, my culpability in all of this is that I did not come back enough to check on her to see her status. And I got there sometimes, and she was like a prune. And all they needed to do was every other hour go to her bedside and take a cotton swab with water and line the inside of her mouth. That's all they had to do. And I raised Cain like I have never raised Cain before. And if you're going to ask my family, they see me raise Cain, they had never seen me in this kind of rage. Right? It's the only time I lost it as a priest. Because they were killing my parishioner. Right? This poor woman. I mean, I'm sure she's in heaven. The way that woman suffered, oh my gosh. I hope she's in heaven. And I hope she forgives me. You know, because I mean, my intent obviously was not to neglect her. I had no idea that they were doing that to her. And then they somehow convinced her son, who wasn't really of good judgment anyway, and certainly not dispassionate, clearly, that what they were doing to his mother was okay, it's natural. That is not what people look like, or supposed to look like, when they die naturally. They should be as well hydrated as possible. As possible. Now, sometimes people cannot, and by the way, it is very easy and cheap to keep someone hydrated. Intravenous dextrose and water or sugar water. Plenty, I mean, the body can survive a long time without food. Without water, however, but isn't it 70% of our body is water, something like that, right? Without water, we're in big trouble. But if we don't have food for a while, you can make it. Okay, so am I equating this with dramatic weight loss? Not necessarily. But I'm talking about, she looked like a child from Ethiopia, you know, in the famine days in the 80s, like that. Not necessary. All she needed was an IV, and I had to fight to get that. And eventually she succumbed. Ah, may she rest in peace. Horrible. Watch out for hospice. Hold on for a second. There's no time for personal witness. You got a question? Okay, all right. I got to move on to the next question. Okay. Now, what is the correct response to, from From ashes you came, and to ashes you will return. Is Ash Wednesday?
Coming.
Yeah? Nothing. You can say amen if you want. But this is my favorite posture for Ash Wednesday. Have it. Right? It's like the people who genuflect at the movie theater. They go down the side aisle. You know they're Catholic, right? I mean, that's a Catholic. I love it. I've done that before, I have to admit. Anyone done that before? Go ahead. Admit the shame. All right, it's okay. I'm genuinely, yeah, it was the passion of the Christ. Okay, no. I genuflected to the real absence. There was nothing there. Okay. So, no, you know what? I'll tell you this, though. What I wanted to do, you know, you figured these, like, you know, get rich quick schemes, your $1 million thing. I thought one time of selling table salt, right? And it would be called Lot's Wife. Table salt. Because remember she turned into a pillar of salt, leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, and she turned around? Or the Lot's Wife's Deer Licks. You know? Okay. So my next one was...
I'm so glad you have your day job.
Yeah. My next one is the ash cookie cutter, but miniature. So you have the altar boy hold the ashes, and you just go dip, 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 boop. Instead of doing it with a finger, just whoop, 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 whoop. Yeah, like it's like stamping people on the head. Yeah. Yep, yep. Yeah, okay. Very efficient. Yeah, absolutely. Shape of the cross, yeah. Because my problem with my finger control at Ash Wednesday is that I actually have left, I'm not joking, question marks on people's foreheads. So they come back to office with a question mark. Because I just missed, you know, and ashes are tough to handle. Trust me, they are bad investments, okay? Next question. Now, what's the best way to read the Bible? Well, okay, where should you begin or by a chapter? All right. Has anyone seen biblical timeline, historical narrative timeline, the Bible? It's how to read the Bible in chronological order. You don't go Genesis to Revelation. You go Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and then you skip. And then you come back to Deuteronomy. And then you skip. Okay? If you're interested in that, email me. fatheremagat@gmail.com. You can read the Bible in order, cover to cover, in 1 year. And the little timeline I have is great because it tells you how many chapters you have to read of what book today. And if you get behind because of other things, you can just catch up. Okay? But if you try to read the Bible Genesis to Revelation, ho-ho. Now, I know some people who have read the Bible doing this way in a year, and they've done it 3 or 4 times. And that's what they always are doing, reading the Bible cover to cover. Now, that being said, if you attend daily Mass through the 3-year cycle, you only miss 4 books of the Jewish scriptures if you read everything else. You will hear in the first reading, and the Gospels, obviously, all the readings of the year. So if you have the Magnificat, and you read the readings in the Magnificat every day, even though you don't come to Mass, if you go through the cycle A, cycle B, and cycle C, when you get to cycle C, you will have just missed all but 3 or 4 books of the Jewish scriptures. Pretty good, right? But that's the church's cycle of readings to keep us through all the books alive, except for 4. Okay? And I shouldn't say all of 4, parts of 4. Like Song of Songs, you know what Song of Songs is? Song of Songs is sort of an erotic love poem. You know, the deer hearkens over the... It's like, okay. Very embarrassing to read as a celibate during Mass, okay? All right. That's why I do not permit it during weddings. My lover is a stag. Oh, gosh. Okay. Please. It's in the Bible. All right. What is the difference between offering a personal intention at Mass as opposed to asking the priest to make the intention? Is one more worthy than the other? Yes. Okay. I think this is the distinction maybe being asked. Let's say you're looking at the bulletin and there's a Mass intention in the bulletin. Okay? But you come to Mass with your own intention. Okay. Now, why is the priest's intention more efficacious? Not because he got a stipend, although that is notable. Okay? Right? But because the priest himself is offering the sacrifice. He is mediating all of the other sacrifices in the hearts of the believers there present, and even the sacrifices being offered in absentia by the souls in purgatory. Okay? Or maybe praying for themselves. Get me out of here! Okay? Alright. So,
But the priest offering the intention, that's the most efficacious of the intention being offered for the Mass. Right? Because he's the one offering that intention. Now, is it, you know, how less efficacious is it to have your own intentions during Mass? I don't know. I mean, you know, a lot of people who are not priests, when they write me letters and say, as a gift to you on your birthday, I will offer up 3 Holy Communions for your intentions. Okay, it's very nice. Okay? Am I going to kick that back to them and say, not interested? I say my own Mass, leave me alone? No. You know, that's fine. That's nice. Because what they're saying is that all of the graces attached to receiving communion on these 3 instances, I will offer on your behalf. That's very nice. That's a very nice gift. Okay, if you want to do that for me, you can do that. Okay? All right. Okay. That actually is not just here. That could be anywhere. The question was, sometimes the Mass intention is announced, and sometimes it's not. Okay. Now, that's a matter of personal preference. Can the priest announce the Mass intention? Sure. It's as fluid as what he says in his homily. Now, Father DiMartino does not sit down with me on Saturday night and says, can I please see the text of what you're going to say tomorrow? He does not. 1, he doesn't have the time, and 2, he doesn't have the interest. And 3, even if he had a preference for what I said, he can't make me do it. If he says that, then I say, well, then you say the Mass. Of course, he's not going to do that either, right? He's like, well, no. So there's like a gentleman's agreement that we're going to preach the Orthodox faith. Okay, now I've been in situations where that's not always true, unfortunately, Joan, but that's the way life goes sometimes. All right, so can the priest announce the Mass intention? Yes. Maybe the better question is, how come some of us do, and how come some of us don't? That's the question. Okay. The reason I don't is because I have been guilty many times of butchering someone's name. And that, I think, in my experience, has caused more pain than consolation. They are embarrassed, okay? It also shows that I don't know them, which I suppose I'm supposed to, but how could I possibly know everybody, okay? All right. Now, that's why we post it publicly in the bulletin, so that no matter how you pronounce that name, you know. Now, there is one Eucharistic prayer, the first one, the Roman Canon, which is the one we do in Latin Mass, where in the canon of the Mass, in the Eucharistic prayer itself, it says, especially for those for whom we now pray. And it says there in red, you can mention the name here. You can. You don't have to say you must. You can. Sometimes I do if I know the name. If I do not know the name and I'm afraid that I might mispronounce it, I won't, because it's listed in the bulletin. And then the same thing for the dead, especially those for whom we now pray. Okay? So that's the only reason why. And so, do I have to? No. Do I choose to? No, generally speaking. Now, then here's the problem. If I do sometimes, but I don't other times, then people say, how come you didn't mention my grandma's name and you did it for that person? Okay, see what I'm saying? So if I just don't know across the board, no one can complain. It's posted in the bulletin. Unless you don't know how to read, don't talk to me about it. Okay? Read the bulletin. It's not my problem. Okay? All right. I just can't, you know, believe me. If I had to answer for every single request made of me or answer every complaint, I'd be like toast. Okay? I can't do that. All right. So, those are questions. Any other questions? Go ahead, Marie. The morning after pill. Okay. Does anyone else want to talk about the morning after pill? Francis does. You have another question? Because that's mandatory, abstinence from meat. Whereas outside of Lent, it's not mandatory because you can commute meat to other penances. Like, remember the beer or the ice cream? It's not mandatory. There's a difference. In Lent, it's mandatory. Now, one question no one has asked me yet is, what happens if you eat meat on a Friday during Lent? No one, well, okay. This is a very interesting question, Jim. Is it mortal? Well, all right. In the Catechism, The catechism, Marie, could you find this for me? The six precepts of the church. The six precepts of the church. One of them is observing all fast and abstinence days in the calendar. Then another one is supporting the works of the church. Now, is not doing these things grave matter? How many of you think yes? Grave matter. Okay. How many of you think no, not grave matter? Okay. Yeah. I don't know how to answer the question, but do you see the precepts of the church there, Marie?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, you know, I'll tell you this, though. It's a good question you ask. Well, it's a good question I ask for you. And that is because people do come to confession during Lent and said, Father, it was Ash Wednesday. I was out of the country. It's not a holy day of obligation, by the way. But trust me, do you know what the two most populated days of the year are at church other than Easter and Christmas? Ash Wednesday and Palm Sunday. Now, what do those two things have in common? You get stuff. And when you get stuff, people come. Because it's just like when we go to technology or conventions, and you go there anyway, even though you're not even going to talk to a single rep, but you want to get your pens, your magnets, your paper clips, and everything else, right? You get stuff. So people come to Mass in the same way because you get stuff. Now, do some people come to Ash Wednesday because they really want to begin Lent? I hope so, and in fact, I know so. Does everybody? No. Because the next time you see them after Ash Wednesday is Easter Sunday, or Palm Sunday, depending on whether or not they want to get stuff. Okay, here are the precepts, 2042. First precept, attending Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation, and rest from servile labor. Number two, confess your sins at least once a year. Easter duty. Number three, receive the sacrament of the Eucharist at least during the Easter season. Part two of the Easter duty. Fourth precept, you shall observe the days of fasting and abstinence established by the church. Fifth, you shall help to provide for the needs of the church. That means contributing to the collection. And the last one, there are two more they added. Since they wrote this. Obeying the marriage laws of the church. Marrying in the church. And the duty to evangelize. Woohoo! Those are the seven precepts. That's a good homily, isn't it? My other homily I have coming up in the spring, I hope I get to, is the seven automatic ways you can be excommunicated. Ooh. Don't worry. I don't think any of you are in danger. But if you are, I'll let you know. Okay. So those are the six precepts of the church. Now, this is a very interesting question because, the church has put these things out there. I actually would tend to agree that not following the fast and abstinence rules on Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, and the rest of the Fridays during Lent is a grave matter. And I'll tell you why. Not making your Easter duty, another precept of the church, is a grave matter. So when people come to confession to me, and I hope this happens to every priest. I don't know if it does. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 2 years since my last confession. Okay, at the end of the confession, I say, were you aware of the Easter duty? No. What's that? Okay, means you have to go to confession and communion at least once a year. Okay. Now, we get back to another question. Vincibility or invincibility of knowledge. You see how difficult this can get? And I'm trying to make split-second decisions in the confessional holding someone's soul in my hands. And sometimes, in the manner in which it's handled, whether or not they ever come back to confession again. See why seminary takes 6 years? You better hope it takes at least 6 years. You don't want wily coyotes like me running around. Okay? So they say, no, I didn't know that. Okay, so the question becomes, should you have reasonably been expected to have known it? I don't know. We couldn't even find 2042 in the catechism, let alone what it said. Right? I mean, how many Catholics could recite to you the seven precepts? I mean, how many of us right now could regurgitate the seven precepts I said? Okay. So, yes, it's grave matter, but is the ignorance culpable? Well, probably not. I'm guessing not. Okay? So, therefore, is there a mortal sin? No. See what I'm saying? So you're still dealing with great matter. It's just that the intention and the circumstances certainly mitigate guilt. Okay? So...
Now that you go to this class, yeah.
Well, now that I just read the 7, you... Yeah, I know. It's 2042 in the Catechism. Look it up. And the 6, the other 2 they don't put in is evangelization and married laws of the church. But, you know, you can think of it in these terms. If you're a practicing Catholic, you don't have to worry about any of this stuff because you just do it. I don't know, Joan. Probably in the late 90s, before Pope John Paul II began to decline. Because the five were the original from the Baltimore Catechism, and then they added 2 more. Marriage laws of the church. Why? Because they were being highly disregarded. And then evangelization, because still 40 years after the council, the laity had still not really engaged in evangelization to the degree that the council envisioned. Yes? Was your son here tonight?
Yes.
Man, I wanted to meet that poor fella. Okay, go on. Go ahead, Mom.
He wanted to know what a proper penance would be. I mean,
is there a proper penance for what? Oh, you mean like instead of the front, no meat? Oh, I don't know. I think that's a pretty wide open question. Like, for example, maybe you want to give up TV for the day, or maybe you're not going to go out to the movies tonight. You just stay in. You can still watch a movie, but, you know, that's kind of a fun thing. We went out with friends to the movies. You know? I mean, I think you have to do something. That's kind of a relative answer because it kind of depends on you. Like, me and my friend who likes a tall, cold Sam Adams, right, after work. Hey, John, easy. Yeah, I know. Sam, even Sam Adams, I can get the brand right, okay? He likes a tall, cold Sam Adams on work after Friday. He actually likes it every day after work. But he gives it up on Friday. That's much more penance to him than eating steak. I mean, he's not really much of a carnivore. I mean, it doesn't all matter to him. Okay? Okay. Anything else? You can ask questions. It's fine. It's not my bedtime yet. All right.
One question. Do you know the date Father DeBay is meeting?
Yes. Father DeBay will be here February 14 and 19. That's about this thing of Valentine's. It's easy to remember. He'll be here on Valentine's Day all the way through the 19th. And on the weekend of the 14th and 15th, he'll preach at all the masses. Hallelujah! Okay? And then 16, 17, 18, and 19, that's Monday to Thursday. 16, 17, 18, 19, yeah. He is going to preach at the 9, and in the evening, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, he has an evening conference at 7:30 in the church. And I believe we don't have RCIA that week.
Okay.
We're giving a free pass that week. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Oh, the week of the 14th and 15th. It's in the bulletin. But it will be.
Oh.
It's 11th away. Okay. Just remember, Valentine's Day week, just leave it open. Okay, are we done? Any more questions? All right, Kathy? No. Francis?
I had
one. No.
Well, you know what happened. I had a special...
But not your son.
Yeah, not my son.
Poor kid. Okay.
I found out that